Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. What's up with wages? Despite a recent blockbuster GDP report that the U.S. economy grew more than 4% in the second quarter, pay increases remain anemic nationally and in New Hampshire. In fact, in the Granite State, we're fifth from the bottom when it comes to wage growth, and that's despite our low unemployment and our strength in job creation. Today in The Exchange, it's a New Hampshire economic roundup, and we'll shed some light on this mixed picture of robust employment and weak wages. We'll also look again at housing, especially why the super tight rental market just keeps getting tighter. Let's hear from you too, of course. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And our guests are Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, fresh back from vacation. Welcome back. Good to see
you. Great to see you, Laura.
Also with us, Brian Gottlob, principal at Polycon Research in Dover, which studies economic and policy issues in New Hampshire. Brian, thanks for your time.
Good to be here, Laura.
And also with us, Russ Tebow, president of Applied Economic Research, an economic and real estate consulting firm based in Laconia. And Russ, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Thanks.
So, Russ, I'll start with you, but I want to hear from everybody. 4.1% GDP growth in the second quarter. Wow. What do you make of this, Russ?
I think it's terrific, first of all, to see growth that high. But, you know, our memories are fairly short. If you go back in time, we hit that in 2010, in 2012, and 2014, for not the whole year, but for one quarter. Some people are saying that this is unsustainable, that it's trumped up, if you'll excuse the pun. But really, I think that part of it is that there was a big jump, 10% jump in exports, because people are buying stuff from overseas, are buying American stuff in anticipation of tariffs kicking in and their prices going up. So that part probably is not sustainable. On the other hand, consumer spending was very strong. And if you look at this economy right now, what's, I think, driving a lot of it is these tax cuts and a $1 trillion deficit. So we have $1 trillion that we're going to be spending this year that we didn't really earn, that we're borrowing to spend in the economy as a whole. So my feeling is that we're going to see strong numbers for a while.
Well, and a little bit later in the show, we will talk about consumer spending. Interesting, given that the retail sector here in New Hampshire is having some struggles. So we'll definitely talk about that. But to you also, Brian, what do you think? 4.1% GDP.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit less than meets the eye there. No doubt.
Less than meets the eye.
Yeah, no doubt the economy is strong. Can't say that it's not. But when you look at how they calculate GDP on this annualized basis, I don't pay a lot of attention to one quarter's GDP. Well, the way they do that is they compare the growth of the current quarter to the prior quarter, and then they project that out or annualize it as if it will continue throughout the remainder of the year. So if you actually look at the second quarter GDP, how much it grew over the second quarter of 2017, it's about 2.8%. So this 4.1%, really, it's a great one-time shot, and it will probably continue for a little bit longer, but it's really not indicative of a longer-term trend. Russ made some excellent points. Consumer expenditures are really the highlight, and that's a function, I think, largely of what's happened with the tax cuts. The disappointment for me was on business investment. Now, it was up. It was up about 7%, but it's actually down from the prior quarter. And part of the rationale for this tax cut was that it was going to unlock tremendous amount of business investment, supply side impacts. And in fact, to this point anyway, it really hasn't done that. So that's a little bit disappointing for me.
That's interesting. So that's sort of the more underlying strength that you want to see.
Sure.
Business is saying, thank you for the tax cut. Let's buy some new equipment.
If it's going to be sustainable, then it's got you got to look at what are the impacts going to be on the supply side. What's it going to mean for labor in the long term? What's it going to mean for business and business investment over the longer term?
What do you think, Jeff?
Actually, as Russ and Brian both mentioned, there's some one-off spending going on now here. Like certainly the deficit spending, that's going to be just for now. At some point, it's not. You're going to have to come up with another budget and all that stuff.
You're going to have to pay it back.
Yeah, and you have to pay it back, which is also going to have some interesting effects on interest rates, which will not exactly help the economy. The second thing is that as Brian mentioned, the tax cuts are obviously have been a big boost this year for the economy. But the real rationale behind the tax cuts was to have long-term growth. And if the businesses, which it seems like is, it's anecdotal, I haven't seen any specific numbers, but it seems as if when you read about earnings reports of companies, a lot of that money is going back into stock buybacks, going back to bonuses, into CEOs, not even into wages for their employees, not into big investments, because the investments are pretty flat, I guess. They're staying at 2-point-something trillion, some kind of amount of money, but it's not the huge amounts of money that we've seen in the past. And the other thing is these tariffs, there's just like this looming presence here. That's one of the reasons why exports increased so dramatically. Apparently, specifically soybeans, there was a big rush to get soybeans sent out to China before tariffs started taking effect.
Well, so the soybean surge that
helped ratchet up the numbers even more. That 4.1%, and if the tariffs take effect, there won't be any soybean exports to China. There'll be very few, and that's going to have that'll be a drag on the economy. That's what I'm just saying. There are warning signs about this that should be a concern to everybody, and we'll get into that later in the show.
Well, and I remember last time we met, we talked a lot about the tariffs, given that New Hampshire has a robust export sector. I want to let our listeners know that the three topics we're going to focus on mostly today are jobs and wages and some of the numbers that Brian's been looking at, robust job growth here in New Hampshire, but weak wage growth. And a little bit later, we'll look at consumer behavior, how people are spending their money, spending a little bit differently, but consumer spending is robust. And then a perennial topic, really, housing and how tight it is here in New Hampshire, both for people looking to buy a home and especially rentals. So that's what we're going to be focusing on this hour. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. The number 1-800-892-6477. And Brian, I want to kick off the job growth portion of our conversation with you. You've been looking at these numbers here in New Hampshire. What are you finding?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And first, I have to admit that I've been wrong about job growth in New Hampshire for much of this year. I started out the year saying I thought we were going to grow by less than 1%. I think everybody on this panel, actually, our big concern was in labor force growth. In fact, we've been adding jobs at a rate much higher than our indicated by growth in our labor force. We've added about 10,000 jobs just in the first 6 months of this year, much higher than our labor force growth. So we're exceeding what most of us thought was going to be New Hampshire's ability to create jobs. And when you look at, and I've been trying to figure out why that is, and when you look underlying it, how could that be? How could we add jobs, not reduce our unemployment rate below that 2.7%? And if you look at the unemployment numbers, we've got about the same number of unemployed people as we had 6 months ago. So what's happening?
So it's not that scores of unemployed people are jumping back into the market.
So what's happening? The only way that could happen is if we are somehow getting people working in New Hampshire who are not counted in our labor force, meaning
so they live in Maine.
Yeah, they could be they're working in other states or part of another labor force, but increasingly they're working here. And if you look at some of the unemployment rates around counties that border New Hampshire, they're all much higher than New Hampshire. So I think we're attracting more people into it's really a regional labor force. The other key factor, I think, is, and this will be hard to determine until quite a lag. It'll be a while before we can figure out if this is happening. I think probably we're capturing more of the people who previously had been working outside of New Hampshire. So they're counted in our labor force, but actually have been working elsewhere. So those two factors would allow us to have greater hiring in New Hampshire, but not change the number of people in our labor force.
What about people working part-time, two part-time jobs, Brian? I know a couple of young people this summer who are juggling two jobs.
Yeah, and I think that that plays a small role. If you look at the numbers, the number of people holding more than one job has actually been declining slightly. Yeah, it's not dramatically different, and certainly not enough to account for the substantial increase in the number of jobs above what our labor force growth has been. So it plays a small role, I think.
Who's adding jobs? I'll turn to you first, I think, Jeff. Who's adding jobs in this job growth picture?
Well, mostly, as Ryan said, in the services sector, financial services are still growing, and it's pretty... There's been some very good growth in manufacturing, considering what we've said on this panel for a long time now, the concerns about the manufacturing sector. There's been some really good strong growth in that. I actually know that a couple months ago we had a guy from BAE Systems. They had 500 openings just in BAE Systems.
500 openings.
Yeah, and that's similar in a lot of the tech companies, and that says more about the labor shortage than the growth of the jobs. But there has been a lot of growth in that. There's been a need for more people in the construction sector, but that's just really hard to find. I mean, that's because that's another skilled trade that there's just a shortage of people in that. But for the most part, it's strong pretty much across the board. It's just kind of confusing sometimes when
right.
you look at that stuff.
Well,
you know,
and confusing because we will look a little bit at the wage growth, which hasn't kept up with the job growth, as Brian has told us. But go ahead, Russ, where are these jobs coming from?
Well, it's very interesting. If you look at, as Brian said, we're showing some good job growth overall at the top line number of total jobs added. But then also the state reports on the metropolitan area job growth, Dover, Portsmouth, Manchester, Nashua. And if you add up that job growth, it's only about half of the total. So either there's some sort of statistical weird thing happening here, or we're starting to see job growth in areas outside of the metropolitan areas. And we've talked on this show a lot about, it's urban, rural in New Hampshire. But I don't know if this is a statistical quirk or whether it's reality. But I know all of the metro areas are growing. But if you add up their growth and compare it to the statewide growth, they're a little short. So I think some of it is maybe the tourist areas like Conway are doing well, Lakes Region doing a little bit better. These are non-metropolitan areas. Lebanon, Hanover doing pretty good. So we are seeing some dispersion of the job growth, which is nice to see, actually. That's one thing. The other thing that I noted in getting ready for the show, and not to at all disagree with Brian's points about the labor force, but if you look at June over June figures, the labor force actually grew quite a bit in New Hampshire, and it's the first time we've seen that. It's up around 10 or 15,000. And again, I don't know if it's a statistical quirk, whether it's fake data, but it's there. It's in the numbers that June over June figures show a significant increase in the labor force. And it's not seasonal because you're comparing the same month to years.
Well,
may be seeing enough job growth to that people that said, well, I don't want to do that job, but I'll take a job at New Hampshire Public Radio.
Yeah, exactly. We do hear about people who maybe they were younger retirees, and then they kind of look at the job market and they go, oh, okay, that looks pretty good.
Yeah.
Healthcare. I read a report over the weekend, Russ, that I think a third of the growth in jobs in New Hampshire is coming from the healthcare sector.
I don't know if that's right, but that sector's been growing, and I think it's very notable, that the manufacturing sector added 2,000 jobs year over year.
Because those are supposedly good
jobs. And the
jobs,
openings
so
are huge.
Them.
The advertised openings for production workers, those are just huge. So we're seeing a kind of a broadening. For the longest time, we had growth in retail, healthcare. Some of the services that paid below average wages. We're seeing a lot of demand for construction and manufacturing, which pay better wages.
Well, so that's interesting, and that gets to what we talked about before, this 4.1% GDP growth. Is it sustainable? Is it a one-off? Brian, from what Russ says, it sounds like this job growth bodes well for New Hampshire. Some of these jobs are, again, what economists like to call good jobs, paying good salaries with good benefits and reliable, you know, they're reliable.
Yeah, no doubt about it. The strong job market has brought more individuals into the labor market in New Hampshire. Participation rates, and I should have said labor market has grown, labor force has grown pretty substantially, just not enough from my perspective to sustain what we're on path for, which is an over 2% employment growth on the year, which we haven't seen, by the way, in a couple of decades.
Right, so you're wondering, who are these folks?
Yeah, exactly. So I do think we're bringing more people into the labor market, but, you know, I look at the numbers nationally, and it's you don't really get this number for New Hampshire, at least not in a timely manner. And if you look at what's happening in the labor market and who's being brought in, the last 3 months, hiring has about 1.1 million individuals have been hired who have a high school degree or less. And there's actually been a slight decline in the number of people hired who have a bachelor's degree or higher or have some post-secondary education. Now, that doesn't mean there's layoffs in people with post-secondary. It just means that we've got retirements, and they're just not being replaced because there aren't enough of them. So I hate to say this, but we're kind of scraping the barrel of the labor pool right now. So I don't see that what's coming into the labor market is really contributing a lot to higher-end job growth. I think what's happening is it's certainly helping job growth at the lower end, and that's got a couple of implications. One, it has an implication for wage growth. If you're bringing in people with the less talent or the less skills, that's going to, at higher rates, that's going to keep wage growth down. It also has implications for productivity growth, which is a big part of what has been constraining GDP growth in the country. We haven't had a lot of productivity growth. So if you're bringing in more less skilled people and they're not as productive, then that can explain a couple of factors, both slower GDP growth overall, but also a big part of, I think, the slower wage growth in New Hampshire.
Well, we should talk about the wages for sure. And again, I want to invite our listeners to join us, 1-800-892-6477. What are your thoughts about this job growth that we're talking about, where it's happening, where it isn't, and as Brian is alluding to, the slower wage growth that we're seeing here in New Hampshire? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Russ, we've talked about this before on the show. Wages are still sticky here in New Hampshire. I'm kind of surprised, given the job growth, given the low unemployment rate.
Yeah, if you look year over year, they're worse than sticky. They actually, on average, went down a tiny bit. And it's not that people are earning less at their job. It's just the mixture of jobs change. But overall, we've had no wage growth, average weekly wages in New Hampshire.
So why is that?
Year
How
over
can
year.
Employers pay well, people less I mean, when if, there's such a demand?
There was a great article in actually yesterday's New York Times by David Leonhardt about income growth. In the 80s, it was dispersed very broadly across the various sector, the profile of income. So the lowest 10% got money. The highest 10% got money. And this was, you know, going back over time, measured in the 80s. Now, all of the wage growth virtually is the top 1%. Income growth, not wage growth, income growth is in the top 1%. So we have a very disproportionate distribution of income now compared to what it's historically been. It used to be that everybody benefited when the economy was doing well and incomes were going up. Now it's just so concentrated in the very top end of the earning category that middle income people are not really experiencing the benefits of this economy. Low income people aren't to the same degree, not even close to the top 1%.
So that's why we see this strong job growth, weak wage growth. Jeff, I can see you want to jump in, but we'll pick it up after a short break. And you can join us too. We'd love your thoughts, personal experiences with this. 1-800-892-6477. Also, coming up, we'll talk about retail. If wages are only growing slowly, how is that affecting consumer spending? Also, what kind of retail is doing well in this economy and what kind isn't? All that's coming up, so stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Laura Canoy. The Exchange has been going local all summer, exploring the unique regions of New Hampshire. And as part of our series, we'll be heading to Keene, the heart of the Monadnock region, to discuss the biggest issues facing that area and what residents love most about their home. The show will be live at Keene State College on August 16th at 9 a.m. So reserve your free tickets now at nhpr.org/events. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Canoy. Today, it's our New Hampshire Economic Roundup, and we've been looking at job growth, which, as we're hearing, is healthy in the state, but wage growth remains slow. So we'll spend a few more minutes looking at that. Then we'll look at consumer spending and how that's shifting. Later on the hour, another examination of New Hampshire's housing crunch, both for home buyers and especially renters. Join us on these topics. We'd love your thoughts and personal experiences. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are Jeff Feingold with New Hampshire Business Review, Russ Tebow, president of Applied Economic Research, and Brian Gottlob, principal at Polycon Research in Dover. And before I go to our listeners, gentlemen, Jeff, I did want to give you a chance to jump in again on this issue of, you know, job growth is robust, unemployment is quite low, but for some reason wages are not keeping up with what you'd expect
there. Yeah, and also I was listening to a really fascinating podcast the other day. It was a UK-based podcast, and it was an economist talking specifically about wage growth. And this is not just a U.S. phenomenon. It's something that's going on in the EU and in the UK also. And they were talking about how this wage growth is that he just was trying to explain what it was. But the interesting thing to me that stuck out was that in the UK, specifically, he said that one of the problems is that people aren't looking for new jobs because they're afraid of Brexit, that if they might lose their jobs. So that's keeping people in their jobs and not looking for other jobs. In the EU, there are other concerns, but the main thing is that the EU is such a big area now that there are countries like Greece, Spain, Portugal, those nations where they have lower wages than they do in, let's say, Germany, France, and Italy and places like that. So that has different constraints. But one of the things that stuck out to me was that he mentioned that in all these places there's less union membership, that labor unions are losing their power, and that has historically, at least in the last 100 or so years, has been a factor in driving wages up. But as we've seen in New Hampshire and elsewhere in the United States, that they have less and less strength, there's less and less membership, and that has been one of the factors in driving, in keeping wages lower,
We could probably talk about wages and jobs for a whole hour. Maybe we should have done that.
I think we already have.
Yeah, exactly. But let's go to our listeners. Love your thoughts and personal experiences with this issue, again, of robust job growth, less than robust wage growth. 1-800-892-6477. And guys, Nicole is calling in from Manchester. Hi, Nicole. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm actually a recruiter, and I recruit all over the United States. And I definitely see the trends they're talking about. But with scraping the barrel, trying to find talent, I find that there's huge high turnover at these huge companies. So you're just, again, trying to find someone in another 3 months, another 6 months. How do we end that? How do we improve that?
Wow. So you're kind of desperate to find somebody because it's such turnover. Why do you think, Nicole, it's so interesting to hear from you, why do you think there's such turnover at these big companies?
Honestly, the people that still don't have a position at this point don't have a position for a reason.
Because they don't have good work habits and
They don't have good work habits. They don't have the education. They don't have, honestly, the work ethic. So, yeah.
Well, it's really good to hear from you. I'm glad you called, given that we're talking exactly about the field you work in, recruiting. Go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, what caught my ear in Nicole's comments were turnover. And that's one of the things. People have been afraid to leave their job to get a job that might pay a little bit more or maybe even a lot more because of their concerns about job security. So I see this turnover maybe as somewhat of a positive thing where people now have the confidence. And by the way, consumer confidence in New Hampshire is at its all-time high here in New Hampshire and nationally. So I think what's going on is employee ease, are confident enough that if I switch over to this other firm, I'll have a job, continue to have a job in a year, and I'll be making more money.
That's interesting. So we typically look at turnover and go, oh, it's not such a good thing.
I don't think it's a bad thing right now.
It reflects people's confidence. Go ahead, Brian.
It's a great thing, and it's reflected in the national numbers.
It's tough for employers, though.
Well, it is tough, but there is such a thing as the quit rate, which is measured by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Basically, they measure how many people leave their jobs voluntarily, and they usually do so because they want to take another job somewhere else. And Russ is absolutely right. That becomes very low when the economy is weak because people want to hang on to their job and they're nervous about it. Quit rates over the last few months have been as higher than they have been in the last 17 years, which is an indication of how confident people are in leaving one job in order to get another. Now, as a recruiter, you ought to feel pretty good about that because you're going to be constantly asked to fill different positions. But that's an indication of what Russ was talking about. People are much more confident about leaving their positions.
It's tough, though, for employers. Boy, Jeff, yeah. Right? I mean, to train somebody, kind of get them in the groove. Sometimes people make mistakes when they're new to a job. It's not their fault. They're learning, but, you know, it's hard.
Well, depending on the job, it can cost thousands of dollars to train people and to really invest in bringing an employee up to the level where you want him or her to be. And if they're leaving at a faster rate, that's many thousands of dollars for just maybe one job, and that's a lot. That's a big investment.
Yeah, go ahead, Russ.
You know, in a sense, this whole thing about the income thing is people aren't making more income because employers haven't had to pay more to get them. It's that simple. And now we're starting to see where you got to pay up if you want good people.
Yeah. Well, I've heard a couple teenagers, you know, getting jobs dishwashing $12-$13 an hour. So, you know, it's a tough job, but $12-$13 an hour.
Yeah, that was unheard of just even
a
few years ago,
right?
To have that kind of money for a dishwashing job.
Right. All right. Let's go back to the phones. And Nicole, thanks a lot for calling. Joan's in Londonderry. Hi, Joan. Good to hear from you. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead, Joan.
Okay, great. So I just wanted to say that I work for a large company that has offices in multiple states, and they have the exact same jobs in all of the different states. And the job that I do pays a lot more money just over the border in Massachusetts, above and beyond the state sales tax differential. So everybody goes over the border to Mass. Why not? If you're going to make several dollars an hour more doing the exact same job. I think that New Hampshire businesses have been very stingy over the years, and they're just used to the stinginess, and they don't want to pay.
And so you've calculated it, Joan, you know, even with that 5% Mass income tax, it's still worth it for you to, and even the cost of commuting and all that stuff.
Worth it. Because I'm right over the border in Haverhill, and I live in Londonderry, so it's a pretty easy ride.
Yeah.
The commute is very easy, and even with the state income tax, I'm still making several dollars an hour more. And if you file as an out of state resident in Mass, you get most of that money back in a return.
Right. Okay, Joan. Really interesting to hear from you. Boy, who wants to jump in? Brian, you first, because you were kind of talking about these shifts in nearby states.
Absolutely. And I've said this to business groups before. I mean, they complain a lot about the labor market and the labor force. And I tell them, and I've told them for years, if you want to have access to more workers, you've got to wind up paying wages that are more comparable. One of the myths that we have these days is that New Hampshire is a much lower cost state than our neighbors. And if you look, and this is actually calculated again by Bureau of Labor Statistics, they do a price parity measure, which basically compares the cost of living in New Hampshire versus Massachusetts versus Maine. And over the last decade or decade and a half, that difference has narrowed so dramatically between New Hampshire and Massachusetts, and largely has to do with the cost of housing, but it's not completely that. So there's no longer this cost of living differential that for, I think, many years justified or was a justification for employers to pay lower wages. We don't have that now.
What do they say to you when you say, look, guys and gals, stop complaining about your lack of good workers like Joan, who commutes to Massachusetts, you got to pay people more. What do they say?
Well, they still point to the cost differential. Well, there's no income tax here, so you wind up making more.
But Joan's done the math.
Joan has done the math,
and she's not just Joan. I mean,
there's a lot of people.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think that the out migration for jobs is over 100,000 New Hampshire residents work primarily in Massachusetts, in Middlesex County, and the wage differential is 20%.
Yeah, 20%?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a lot.
And all you have to do is, there was a story today on your news about adding a fourth lane to the I-93 expansion, because if all you have to do is go on I-93 in the morning going south, and you know all those people, tens of thousands of people going down into Massachusetts for a job, and it's almost like, as Brian has said, it's like New Hampshire employers are living in a bubble. And they're living in a New Hampshire of, 20 years ago, and it's not the same anymore. But they still have that same mindset.
Interesting. All right. Well, Joan, really nice to hear from you. And let's go to Michelle in Nashua. Hi, Michelle. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. So I just, very quickly, I have a few points to make. I know a lot of people who are unemployed and want to work, yet they lack the transportation, and the bus system in Nashua is woefully inadequate in terms of trying to get to a job on time, et cetera. And I have a degree, college degree, in a specialized area. I make $10 an hour, whereas 20 years ago when I lived in Massachusetts, working in the same field without a degree, I was making 15.
Wow.
Which, when I was like 24, that was pretty cool. Also, I appreciate what your guests are saying. I just want to speak to Brian about, the phrase scraping the bottom of the barrel. I appreciate what you're getting across. But I know still a lot of people who don't have a high school degree, yet one is a master carpenter, another is an exquisite mason. And
so people have skills that are different from, traditional education. And go ahead, Brian.
And that's a mea culpa, because I had notes coming here, and I wanted to talk about that scraping the bottom of the labor pool. And I wanted to say I did not want to sound elitist. And I knew I was going to get in trouble with that, and I didn't get it in there.
Well, don't worry about it, Brian.
Yeah, but, I mean, the fact is that there are more, it's a good thing, more people with fewer skills are getting jobs.
And we'll get the chance to get those skills.
Yeah, and you cannot deny that. I mean, right. I gave you some hiring numbers. 1.1 million people nationally who either, don't have a high school degree or a high school graduate. That's more than people who have some post-secondary education. So those folks are getting hired, and I'm really surprised to hear some skilled trades aren't getting jobs, because those are in tremendous demand right now.
Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
In defense of what Brian said, I don't want to defend too much of it. But I think what Michelle was talking about was not what Brian's talking about. Michelle's talking about people who maybe they didn't finish high school, but they still have great skills as being a mason or a carpenter or a mechanic.
Or they want to learn.
Or an electrician.
High school graduates who can't afford college and just really want to dig
in. And they have the skills. Our education system is still very much not equipped to deal with the current economy. But that's another matter. But what I'm saying is, but I think what Brian was talking about with people who don't have those skills at all, that they don't have, they don't have the any of the skills that really an employer really needs, if he or she wants to hire a good employee.
One point she made that I think is worth highlighting is she talked about public transportation. New Hampshire's not set up well. So let's say you're a young couple, just maybe 25 years old, you're both college graduates, and you're living in pick a town, maybe Goffstown. If you both want a job, you're going to have two cars.
And that's
expensive. Hard to handle. So the lack of public transportation. Now, in contrast, I have a nephew that lives in Boston. He rides his bicycle to work. If it rains a lot, he takes the T. They're fine. They can you can have one person working in Somerville and one person working in the financial district. You both have public transportation. If you look at the Amazon criteria for their new expansion, public transportation was like one of the primary requirements. And New Hampshire, the way we are, have developed relatively low density, doesn't support a efficient public transportation system. Well, and that's a drawback.
It's a great point, Russ. And it gets to something I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, that, you know, the housing in the cities can be more expensive. So if you find a cheaper place, you know, a couple towns outside from a Lebanon, for example, okay, so maybe you can afford that. But then, as our caller points out, which is a great point, you want to work, but you need a car, or maybe
you can't
you need
get
two
there
cars.
From here.
And yeah, I mean, when I was first starting my career, I lived in Washington, D.C. So great. I didn't have a car. And I just look at young people in New Hampshire. I think, gosh, that's something that I didn't have to think about. Repairs, gas, none of that. So
right. Yeah, I have
it was
a son
one
that
less hassle.
You know, it was
and financial drain.
Low to moderate income. And they have to have two cars, which is a drain.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Michelle. And let's go to Greg in Concord. Hi, Greg. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. So I'm someone that's in transition. I left a job I was doing for 5 years, and I'm trying to transition into a different role. And a couple of points. One point to the recruiter that was just saying, you know, people are out of work, mostly for reasons, and also people being unskilled. Well, it's also hard making a transition when you don't have necessarily the job titles. I'm redoing my resume and trying to get experience where I can. But it's hard when you don't have those titles making the change. You can put down transferable skills, you can put down education. It's easier for an employer if they have that role for 5 years to say, yep, that person's been a project manager for 5 years, I'll take the risk. So there's a lot of that challenge. The age piece, I think sometimes there's a tendency, I would say, for people to fish for age and what have you. But mostly trying to transfer those skills and have what someone's looking for when you're changing, that's challenging. Even though there's a lot of jobs, having people take the risk, right?
Yeah, and matching up sort of your past skills with your desire to change. And being a little bit older, as you hinted to, Greg, what do you think, Brian? You know, we talked about workforce shortages. We talked about job growth and where the workers are coming from. What role are sort of slightly older workers playing in this or not playing?
They're not playing nearly enough. And that I think that's got to change. I think that is one of the great untapped resources that we have.
Still, because we've talked about that before.
Yeah, you know, the numbers have increased. People are working longer. And, you know, I was talking to the head of New Hampshire's AARP just recently about this, and we both were saying, look, this is a tremendous resource that is largely underutilized in the state.
Still.
And we're going to have to get over that, because that is still going to be a large portion of the potential labor market anyway. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One, employers sort of they spent decades trying to make their work environments appeal to young people. And we still do that. You know, we're still talking about attracting millennials. The message is everything ought to be about youth. And I think that's a little bit of a mistake. We're going to see kind of the revenge of the baby boomers, because they're going to be in demand. The other thing is, I think there's a myth out there that if people are working longer, it's because they have to. And in some cases, that is clearly true. People do have to. They're not as prepared for retirement. But in many other cases, in New Hampshire in particular, we have a healthier and a wealthier older population than almost any state in the nation. People are living longer, they're healthier, and they could work. And it, not because necessarily they have to, but because they want to. And if they're given the opportunity, I think they would. And I think employers have to step up.
Go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, I was just going to say, one thing that I noticed over the last year or two, the state is very focused, and Jeff has mentioned this on many occasions here, on job training. There are a lot of job training opportunities now in New Hampshire that weren't there. So I think that...
To our caller.
Like our caller,
Greg,
right?
Yeah.
If you can check in with the local employment security and start asking about, okay, well, what kind of job training? Because they're all over the place. Some of them are university-based. Some of them are Labor Department-based. Some of them are employment security-based.
Community colleges are a good resource.
Community colleges, yeah. So there's a lot of help out there now, much more than ever before. And the reason why is everybody knows labor's the problem. Here.
Well, Greg, good luck to you, and we really appreciate your call. So coming up, gentlemen, we're going to talk about housing. And Russ, I'll kick that segment off with you. Some of the numbers that you have about 20,000 housing units short or whatever. It's a lot, and a lot of people who are looking for rentals can probably relate. So we'll talk about that coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Wednesday on our show, we kick off a series of interviews with the 2nd District Congressional primary candidates. We're going to begin this week with Brian Bellinger. So be sure to join us Wednesday on The Exchange as that begins. This hour, it's our New Hampshire Economic Roundup with Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review, Russ Thibault, president of Applied Economic Research, and Brian Gottlob, principal at Polycon Research in Dover. Let's hear from you. We've been talking about strong job growth here in the Granite State and relatively weak wage growth. We've been looking at that and hearing your stories. Also, we're going to turn for a moment to New Hampshire's housing crunch, both for home buyers and especially renters. As always, let's hear your stories and personal experiences as our listeners have been sharing with us this morning. It's really interesting to hear your own take on these questions. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So housing, gentlemen, and boy, that's a topic we talk about almost every time we get together. But Russ, there's so much to examine here. You put some numbers out recently saying that New Hampshire is under building housing by 20,000 units, something like that. Help me out, Russ.
Right. If you go back to 2012 and you look at the job growth that we've had, which we talked about earlier in the show, and you look at the historic relationship between housing construction and job growth, we're around 20,000 units short in that six-year period of what we should be in
now
terms of
housing
construction.
Unit. Like, what is that? Does that mean a big old McMansion? Does that mean a little apartment in downtown Portsmouth?
All kinds. Rental and ownership both. Around 20,000. By some measures, it could be as high as 25,000. Now, I put that in perspective. We're only building about 3,000 a year. So that means we're like 6 years behind the curve. There was a segment this morning on the National Public Radio about Boise, Idaho.
Yeah,
with
really
the same
interesting
thing. They talked about 2.7% unemployment. They talked about housing construction being one-tenth what it should be. It could have been about New Hampshire.
Yeah, it really could have. You could have inserted New Hampshire for Boise, Idaho.
Yeah.
It was interesting.
Now, I look at a lot of data. I just want to maybe go a little bit off the data just for a quick moment and acknowledge the passing of a friend of mine who did all of this data work for the Housing Finance Authority, Dan Smith, who passed away last week.
And I just want to.
Yeah, it's been 20 or 30 years where I've been able to call him, look at his charts. It's made my job so easy. A great, humble, competent man, and I'm going to miss him. But anyway, these are his numbers. If you look at housing prices, 2012, the median home price in New Hampshire dropped at one point to $180,000. It's now $240,000.
That's a big jump in
That's
a short
huge.
Period of time.
Yeah. Now, that followed a decline of around 20%. So but home prices now in New Hampshire at an all-time high. Interest rates are rising. You talked about rental income in every county in New Hampshire. Coos County, the rents are low, but the incomes are low too. So about half of the renters in the state are paying more than they should, which is the measure is 30% of your income on housing. So we're not building enough units. We have a lot of appreciation on the home ownership front, which is good for sellers but bad for buyers. And rental rates now, it's almost $1,300 a month to rent a two-bedroom apartment in New Hampshire. And that works out to, I'm trying to do the math in my head, $16,000 a year maybe, just for that rent.
So let's look at that statement. And Jeff, to you first. So not building enough housing units in New Hampshire, and a lot of people out there looking for affordable housing would probably agree. But why is that? I mean, on this program, for example, last week we talked with some people from the Upper Valley. And they definitely need more housing there. On the other hand, it's beautiful. Do you really want to pave over, you know, the farm or knock down the barn or chop up more forest to build more housing? So, you know, when we say we're not building enough, there's a balance there.
Yeah, there is. I mean, especially in New Hampshire, that's been going on. You know, that tension has been existing for many, many years. I think part of the problem is there's a difference between building market rate housing, regular housing that can just be built and you can make, you know, you can sell a house for $1 million or whatever, and affordable housing, the stuff that we really are looking for.
Smaller houses, apartments.
Yes, exactly. And in many cases, there's a problem among, especially smaller towns, they have zoning laws that restrict that kind of construction. But there's another thing that's happening in New Hampshire that's not helpful. And in many states, especially surrounding states, they have basically affordable housing funds that inject in some cases tens of million dollars, and in some cases hundreds of millions of dollars. Massachusetts' fund is in the hundreds of millions. Maine has, I think, 50 million, or Vermont has a lot of money. New Hampshire's is very small, and it's a way of just helping developers tap some extra money to help lower the cost, of borrowing that money, and building the units with kind of like a subsidized price. But New Hampshire doesn't have that level of involvement, because of our limited resources, whether it's self-inflicted or not.
A free market, free market philosophy.
But that unfortunately is one of the tools that other states are using, is to have this kind of help from the state to help. I'm not saying these affordable housing problems exist in Massachusetts and Maine and all those other places, but there's attempts by the state government to try to alleviate the situation. In New Hampshire, it's pretty much hands off. It's not completely hands off, but it's pretty much hands off, and that's been a tough thing to build affordable housing.
So the idea, Brian, is hey, if people really want affordable housing, smaller units, and so forth, the market will provide. But as Russ has told us, the market isn't necessarily providing.
Yeah, it's not providing for a number of reasons, I think. One of which is that communities, in many communities, they're really not capable. Their regulations really aren't capable of handling developments of smaller units. They're just not designed for that.
Their water and sewer might not be enough to support those units.
And I don't think that's going to change until communities begin to realize that their economic future is really dependent on the ability of people to live in their communities or nearby. And it's not just I do blame affordable housing a little bit for this, because they only talk about building affordable housing, and that's important, no doubt about it. But if you build any multifamily housing, affordable or not, you increase the supply, and you
so all types of housing,
you help reduce the pressure for increases. So if they just understood that building more, and particularly building more multifamily housing, some of these communities, they would increase the opportunities that they have for a more vibrant economic future. That's going to take a while for them to realize.
Well, okay, so just on that point, and Russ, I'm going to turn to you, because this story comes from Laconia. Here's a story that came across just recently in the Laconia Sun. And as many listeners know, the former Laconia State School is a big property that city's been looking at. According to this article by Rick Green, residential development won't be the focus for redeveloping the former state school property. A state panel decided Monday. Apparently, they hired a consultant, which came back with a report, said, you guys need housing. Your economy is hampered by a lack of housing for workers, as you said, Brian. The consultant said a residential-driven concept was the most feasible option. But then the city said, nah, we think we want to make make it a, quote, jobs generator. From everything you guys have said, the jobs are here. It's the housing we need for the people to fill those jobs.
Well, I've been involved in that process. I was not the consultant that recommended all housing.
Full disclosure.
I don't want to get into the weeds too far.
But it's interesting.
The initial early thinking looked at the short-term opportunities and that market opportunities. That was housing. And made the point that, look, you need housing. Housing's part of economic development. But the statute that the state passed to set up the commission that's looking at this issue said, we want economic development, we want job growth, we want to use this as a job generator for the region.
But where are those people going to live?
I know, you're right. So it's actually now, the article was accurate in most of its regard, but each of the three proposals right now that are out there have housing in it to varying degrees.
Housing components.
But the initial one had one option that was total housing.
Interesting. Go ahead, Jeff.
Actually, we had a story about this a couple of months ago when the first report came out from this company. As it's developed, the consultant is based in Albany, New York. And in the article, Mayor Engler of Laconia said, we don't need jobs, we need employees. And that's what businesses are looking for. They're looking for employees. And that was the argument for having housing. And it's good to hear they're still thinking of having a housing component in there, because that is desperately needed, especially in Belknap County, because they've been losing jobs, losing good jobs over the last several years. And I think if you had a pool of employees, you would help solve a lot of the problems that they have
in
Laconia.
Really, we need both. We need jobs and housing in Belknap County. So,
but do you need jobs? You guys have been telling me all hour that there's plenty of jobs.
We need good
workers
jobs
and housing. Okay.
I have to say, in 2005, I did a report for Belknap County Economic Development Corporation, and one of the highlights and one of the recommendations I had is that they needed to have rental opportunities in and around the Laconia area. There was really no rental properties of, you know, quality rental properties, and that would allow, you know, a city, this is amazing, a city on a lake, a beautiful lake, between 2010 and 2000 and 2010 actually lost population. That is just unheard of on a city on a lake, a beautiful lake.
But so maybe
there's
just
not
places to live.
Exactly.
It's because my four children moved away. That's it, Brian. Sorry.
Well, you got to work on that.
No more work on
get those grandchildren back.
Again, the number for you to join us on our New Hampshire Economic Roundup. So much to look at today. 1-800-892-6477. We're talking about job growth and sticky wage growth. So you can join us on that. Also, this conundrum in New Hampshire of not enough housing in some communities. Again, you can email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Fred joins us from Wentworth. Hi, Fred. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Fred.
Yes. Good conversation, but it seems to me it is mostly about southeastern New Hampshire and the Lebanon, Hanover, greater metropolitan area, commuting range. I live outside of that area, and the world you're talking about doesn't seem to relate very well to the economy. Cost of living delightfully lower, and the jobs opportunities, most of which are local tradespeople and getting good wages and always have. I'll stand by and listen to what you have to say.
So a different world, it seems like we're talking about. And I just want to let you know, Fred, that 3 weeks ago we did a whole program on the North Country as part of our Going Local series. And then 2 weeks ago we did the White Mountains. So we looked at some of the issues. And you're right, Fred, the housing situation is different in the North Country, more affordable. The jobs picture remains mixed. I wonder what you think, Russ.
Well,
thank you so much, Fred, by the way.
Yeah, there's no question that he's right, that that if you get north of Concord, you feel like you're in a different world. And economically, when you look at the numbers, you say, where did this come from? You know, oh, that's the North Country. But I would say that there still are great imbalances in terms of housing affordability, which we've been talking about in the North Country. In fact, The county in the state where housing is least affordable is Coos County, where rents are also the lowest because incomes are lower yet. So in southern New Hampshire, you have better income growth and higher rents. In the North Country, you have lousy income growth and somewhat lower rents, but not enough to offset for the economy. So it's really the housing crunch is almost statewide in terms of new construction, where you're getting a lot of job growth in southern New Hampshire. It's more about construction. In the North Country, it's more about affordability.
Well, and you see people making long commutes. And Fred, I've got a friend who lives in Milan who lost his job, the company downsized, and commutes to Lincoln, which is quite a commute from Milan. So, I hear what you're talking about, Fred. Thank you for calling in. Michael's calling from Concord. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi.
Go ahead, Michael. Yeah.
I'd just like to comment that on the housing front, the interest of the state is to grow the population effectively and add to the workforce. The interest of the towns is to preserve their property values and their presumed quality of life, and they're in conflict. It's as simple as that. I mean, the reaction even to the state school project, when people said, when they proposed residential, a large number of people said, what do we need with more people? We don't want more houses. We want open space.
Yeah, which, you know, you understand. I mean, open space has its own definite values. And we understand now that open space helps clean the water, helps clean the air, helps ecosystems, basically You need open space, but go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, no, I think that perceived conflict is really more perception than reality. The bottom line is that communities' future and the economic future and their vibrancy and by definition, you know, the values of their of the properties that are there are dependent on a strong economy. And the only way that's going to happen in the future and going forward is if they can add individuals. And that's what's increasingly determines those areas that are more economically vibrant and are growing and those that aren't. So unless you can add people, demographics is the new economic development. The ability to get not only people but skilled, well-educated individuals is what will determine the economic health of communities and regions, and those that are attracting or keeping those individuals have stronger economies. So, and the only way you can do that is if you got places for them to live. So it's more of a perception, and communities need to understand that they have to allow for that kind of residential development if they want to long-term assure the vibrancy of their communities.
And I think that was Michael's point. I mean, I think it really is that you have these zoning laws, you have these two-acre lots to build one house for a family. That's against the interests of the state to increase the population and the interests of that community in the long term.
Well, Russ, why don't we get more, we collectively, the state, get more creative? If people don't want to bust up open space, which I totally understand, given the economics, the environmental services that open space provides, why don't we make more creative use of the buildings that we already have? You know, abandoned malls, for goodness sake. Old factory buildings. Look at what Manchester's done with the Mill Yard, turning some of that into businesses, but some of it into housing. So if people don't want new buildings eating up open space, why don't we make more creative use of the buildings that are already here?
We're pretty good on the adaptive reuse of older mill buildings. If you go around the state in Rochester, Dover, Franklin has one project recently completed, a new one about to start, Newmarket, Nashua. So we're doing pretty good on that. And I think that the sentiment is beginning to change a tiny bit. Nashua, for example, is advocating trying to get housing built, whereas for maybe 10 years ago, it was like, no more, enough. One thing I would point out also is the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority has just started a study looking at how regulations, what Mike talked about, are affecting housing costs in New Hampshire. I was in Portsmouth, and the nice part of Portsmouth you like, down around Strawberry Bank, the houses are right on the street. Here, in most cases in New Hampshire, you have to be back 75 feet. That means more costly lawns, more costly driveways. So we got to rethink a little bit our regulatory environment.
All right. Well, lots to dig into next time that we didn't even get to today. Guys, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate
it. Great being here, Laura.
Thanks, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.